The new head of Florida prisons believes the system could be near collapse. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Mark Inch, a former Army general, is concerned that the prison system in the Sunshine State is operating below its historic standards. And he's pointing to lawmakers for taking so much money away from prisons as a big reason for the decline. Also,
the steamboat, it's just such a very special object of the past. I think it just really talks about the pioneer days. It really visually takes you there.
When you think of steamboats, you may think of the Mississippi River. But there's a new photo exhibit in Palm Beach County on a steamboat, a replica of the sort that used to travel our waters. Finally, for Miami Art Week, we're going to take you on a trip to an exhibit called Black Power Naps. It looks at the sleep gap and how people of color struggle to get enough sleep. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. The new head of Florida's Department of Corrections is worried that the state's prison system is on the brink of failure. He believes there are signs that Florida's prisons could one day experience a riot that as big as the one in 1980 in New Mexico. That's where prison guards were held hostage and 33 inmates were killed. Now, Florida's prison system right now is the third largest in the nation. Mary Ellen Kloss is the State Capitol Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. She covers government affairs and focuses on investigative and accountability reporting. She's joining us now from Tallahassee. Mary Ellen Kloss, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Lewis.
Tell us a little bit about Mark Inch and why Governor DeSantis brought him in to try to turn around our prisons.
Mark Inch is a newcomer to Florida. He came here. He served briefly in the Trump administration as head of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, but he spent most of his career in the Army. He's a retired two-star Army general. He worked with the military as a battalion commander and headed up the military's maximum security prison in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. So he comes here with prison background, not a lot of state government, no state government experience. So he's kind of a newcomer, and we'll see how he does.
You know, I mean, he thinks that Florida's prisons are crumbling and really that they're very close. It could be, you know, complete failure. But you've reported so much on this. Is he right? What's the state of our prison system right now?
Well, you know, it's kind of refreshing to actually have somebody come in who sees that the same warning signs that everybody's been, that many others have seen, are still there. And he acknowledges the warning signs as opposed to masking them over. And I think that's a pretty bold thing to be doing, especially for someone new into the state of Florida, because it's not the governor that gets to call the shots on the budget of the Florida prison. It's the legislature. So by him coming forward, he's kind of calling the legislature out by saying it's time to put some more money into this.
And I mentioned at the beginning that he sees the signs, and he believes, Mr. Inch believes, that Florida could go down the same path as New Mexico. Now, he actually wants all the wardens, I don't know if they've already done this or not, but he wanted them to read this book. It's called The Devil's Butcher Shop, and by Roger Morris, and that's the story about the prison riot in Mexico, in New Mexico, right?
Yes, it's fascinating. You know, that's a pretty graphic depiction of what is possibly the most brutal prison riot in U.S. history. And that was pretty deadly. It was for 30 hours over a weekend. Prisoners basically took control of the New Mexico State Penitentiary in Santa Fe. They mutilated and murdered 33 inmates. They hacked people with knives, tortured others with blow torches. They took 12 corrections officers hostage and raped and terrorized others. And it was so horrific that this kind of goes down in legendary terms in the corrections community as, you know, the worst thing that could happen. But what is fascinating is that this book has a whole chapter called Foreshadow. And in it, the author shows all the warning signs that were in place to the administration years in advance. And the irony is that Mark Inch, having read that, sees the same warning signs in Florida. And he is trying to get people to understand that we've got to pay attention to them so that what happened in New Mexico does not happen here.
He believes that could happen here.
If things are not changed. Of course, he is very clear at saying, you know, if I think this is imminent, I'm going to, you know, stand on the rooftops and let everyone know. He doesn't think that is, but he also believes that we can't. His direct quote is, this is unsustainable. The status quo is unsustainable. So we can't go another year doing what we're doing now.
How are people responding to that? Do people believe, yeah, maybe this could happen here?
You know, the fact is that I have covered, and the Miami Herald's covered, the correction system for a very long time. These are the same warning signs that the two previous secretaries of corrections have been making. Mike Cruz made it in 2014, and his advice was ignored. Julie Jones, the predecessor to Mark Inch, made similar observations. Now, there have been some incremental changes, but not anything substantial. And, you know, the trend continues.
Obviously, we've never had a riot like that, but we've had riots. We've had problems in our prisons.
Yeah, right. Nothing nearly as bad, because Mark Inch attributes it to the veteran staff in the Department of Corrections and says that they have been able to sort of keep a lid on these problems. But as we have reported, you know, the kind of conditions, the amount of abuse, there are many good people working in the prison system, but there are also a lot of people who should not be there working in the prisons. And the result is that they do things that hurt others.
Yeah, and I want to talk about staffing as one of the problems, because as you said, you've been reporting on this. The Miami Herald and your colleagues have been covering the issues of violence and rape and abuse in the Florida system's prisons. An inmate, the story of the inmate who secretly filmed his experiences at the Martin Correctional Facility, captured a lot of the violence. Reporter Julie Brown just came out with a story today about a Florida inmate that was paralyzed after a vicious attack by guards. How have lawmakers responded to all of these different issues? Every time there's a problem and it's highlighted, how have lawmakers responded to this, and how high is prison funding on their agendas?
Well, prison funding is not high on their agenda. And the reason is that, you know, there is no lobbying force. There are no campaign contributors that give money to advocate for better conditions in Florida's prisons. I mean, it's as simple as that. The Florida Department of Corrections is a $2.8 billion budget. It's the largest state agency that we have, but it is probably the least favored one, because what legislator can brag about giving more money to repairing Florida's broken down and troubled prison system? There is no constituency for it. Now, the constituency should be Florida taxpayers, because the cost of not putting money into this has an immediate bearing on other things. So we have watched as one lawsuit after another is forcing the Department of Corrections to do things that they aren't otherwise able to do, because they have not been given the funding.
I'm talking with Mary Ellen Kloss, reporter, Capitol Bureau Chief, I should say, for the Miami Herald. She's covering government affairs and recently did a story about Mark Inch, who was appointed this year to run Florida's prison system. Her story documents why Inch is warning Florida's wardens and legislators that the system is failing. You can find a link, by the way, to these stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Mary Ellen, looking at the staffing issues, you brought this up a moment ago. You point out that in your story, staffing shortages, low morale, and the fact that you've got staff, you've got guards with very little experience. Who is the typical prison guard right now?
Well, it's fascinating because about two-thirds of the entire the people that are serving as corrections officers in Florida prisons have been there 2 years or less. The turnover rate in the last 10 years is about, has increased 159%. There's one out of every prison guard leaves the system every year. So the cost is enormous because they have to train these corrections officers. They train them, give them the same certification as a police officer. And what happens is they stay there, get the training, and then many of them leave. Many of them leave for better paying jobs because the salaries are so low.
What are the salaries?
The starting salary is $30,000, and it does come with benefits. But the problem is that rate in South Florida isn't enough to get by. In other parts of the state, it's fine. So we've got huge problems with turnover. And many times people get trained and then they go work for a city or county law enforcement agency, and the Department of Correction has paid for their training. So it's expensive.
You have people who come in, they get the training, they spend a year or two, and they leave. The salaries, as you said, starting salary in the 30s. The other thing, too, you pointed out was their shifts. They are working these very long shifts, and there's burnout and even some level of PTSD and, of course, low morale.
That's right. And so, you know, right, the shifts they have, the way they started extracting money from the Department of Corrections happened in about 2011. Governor Rick Scott had campaigned on a promise that he could find a way to cut $1 billion from the prison system. And they first tried to privatize half of Florida prisons. That was that was resisted by the corrections officers union. And so they had to put that on the back burner. But they kept moving forward with the cuts. And the way they did that is they extended everyone's shift from 8 hours to 12 hours. And that way they were able to cut almost 4,000 officers from the system.
You also point out a healthcare crisis within the prison system. Can you elaborate for me, please?
Well, they have also privatized the healthcare system. And in that process, they have tried to save money. It has not saved money. The result is that we have more emergencies right now. There are
within the inmates.
Emergencies within the inmates. You know, people are being helicoptered, life flighted to emergency and evacuations after some trauma or conflict at a prison. There's also been lawsuits because the state has refused to give inmates. There's an epidemic of hepatitis C. The state has refused to treat inmates at the front end, and so many of them are so much sicker. They've now settled into a settlement agreement to treat those inmates. Some estimate that the cost of the medication for those inmates could be as much as $30,000 an inmate. There's just one thing after another because the state has not put money on the front end to deal with many of these problems. The cost on the back end is higher because they're facing lawsuits.
We see this rise in violence within the prisons, gang issues, gang-related issues as well. Obviously, riots that haven't broken out to the point like, you know, we were talking about earlier. But one of the things that Mr. Inch has proposing is an increase in funding because he wants these security threat group sergeants. He wants them at each prison. This, he believes, would help in alleviating a lot of this problem. What are these security threat group sergeants?
Well, he's bringing this from his military background, and he basically says that one of the things they need is to have somebody stationed at each prison who's just in charge of watching gang activity. Because right now, it's estimated that, and this may be even be a low estimate, that at least half of the inmates in Florida's prisons are involved in some gang activity. And so in many places, it is the gangs that are the ones that are in charge. And so they're aware of this this problem, but they don't have a handle on keeping it. He said he believes that if there's somebody assigned in each prison to just focus on gang activity, they get the warning signs much sooner, and they can treat that more effectively.
You see a rise in violence, because part of it isn't it the fact that what are the prisoners doing during the day? Do they have programs? Do they have enough programs, or the cuts just gotten rid of all of them? Educational programs and things they could be doing during the day, so they're not, you know, I guess not doing anything and maybe enticed to, you know, get involved in violence.
That's another thing. So there have been so many cuts in the programming aspect of the prison system that right now the statistic is only 1 in 6 get any kind of educational programming. So that means that these inmates have a lot of idle time. And that is another one of the warning signs that Secretary Inch has identified as what was similar in the New Mexico riots, that he wants to see increase in programming. Of course, going from 6 to even doubling the 6% is an enormous cost. So that's where the investment needs to come into play.
The governor is asking for this. Mr. Inch is asking legislators for this. But with the session coming up in mid-January, do we get a sense that Florida lawmakers are interested in putting this a little bit higher up on their agenda?
You know, I think that's a big question. You know, the governor has suggested, he's taken Secretary Inch's recommendation, and they have proposed putting about $160 million in new money into the prisons. That includes some infrastructure, and it also includes reducing the hours from 12-hour shifts to 8-hour shifts to 8.5-hour shifts for one-third of the corrections officers. They think that that would be a start. And then they've also they've suggested money for what they call wellness officers to kind of help with idleness and work with volunteers who want to come in. They've got some investment. The question is, will the legislature listen to this recommendation? Because previous secretaries have also made recommendations. And when it comes to balancing the budget and deciding whether to put money into other things like tax breaks or, you know, the budget is just a document of choices. And this legislature has chosen time and again not to put it into corrections.
We've been talking with Mary Ellen Kloss, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald, joining us from Tallahassee. Again, you can find her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Mary Ellen, thanks so much for the time.
You're so welcome. Thanks, Lewis.
Well, still to come, we're going to go to a photo exhibit on a steamboat, a replica of the sort that used to navigate Florida waters. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Most artists aim to get their work displayed in a museum or a gallery, sometimes on the walls of a local business. But Sofia Valiente of Belgrade wanted something different. She's displaying her photographs on a replica of a 1920s steamboat. You'll see the boat off of Parker Avenue near West Palm Beach City Place. It's there through next February. The exhibit covers Belgrade's role in the development of South Florida and takes viewers back in time to show the history of the region. Valiente's last exhibit was about Miracle Village. That's the community of sex offenders living near Pahokee. WLRN Palm Beach County reporter Madeline Fox met up with Valiente and talked to her about her inspiration for the project.
So a steamboat replica is not the most typical venue for an art exhibit. Walk me through how that idea turned into what we can see today.
The steamboat came about. I came across these books by Lauren Sewell. He was one of the pioneers to arrive in the area. And one of the books he wrote was about the history of Belgrade. But he also wrote this book called Okeechobee Boats and Skippers. Basically flipped through the book and I saw the Rosetta and I just said, well, that one, you know. Just to me was, you know, wasn't the prettiest of the boats, or wasn't, you know, the boat that would carry the tourists that were trying to visit, you know, Florida, maybe the prospective land buyers, but it was the real boat, you know, it was a freight boat, and it was one that, you know, through the decades survived, and it was the last steamboat to operate on like a Okeechobee, but it would just, to me, had this character of like perseverance. And the steamboat, it's just such a very special object of the past. I think it just really talks about the pioneer days. It really visually takes you there in a way that nothing else really does.
Describe what people see when they walk in and what the exhibit looks like.
So you're walking into a very unique space, of course, very much of a sensory experience. Basically, the exhibit and the storytelling of the photography component begins with how the land used to be and what it looked like, shown in the contemporary context, and talking about some of the very significant pioneers and generations that still exist today that really just kind of give light into those pioneer days. And then the story goes into basically life in Belgrade and communities out there, and basically that, which has been my life living out there for 5 years.
As you mentioned, one of the themes of your work is perseverance and sort of this idea of people overcoming nature and overcoming disaster. And you've spent a lot of your time recently in the last 5 years working out of the Everglades. Why do you think that that area, and how do you think that that area sort of embodies that spirit of perseverance?
Well, I mean, it's just incredible. Like, we were never really meant to live here in Florida. You know, it's just the Everglades. Try to go to the Everglades today and build a farm on it and see how well that goes. Definitely something that took decades, you know, and it's just, it's a tremendous story for me. It's always that same, you know, that westward expansion story that, you know, occurred in the Western territories. It's the same exact story of, you know, mom and pop people coming with whatever they had or selling whatever they had, you know, to try to make a living, you know, for a better life. I mean, that's just really amazing. I think that's the human spirit, even this pioneer spirit, you know, of like wanting something better and just saying, I'm going to leave here and I'm going to go here and I'm going to make a life for myself. And I have no idea what I'm getting into. And in fact, these people had no idea what they were getting into. It was said that they were buying land by the gallon out here. And so half the year was underwater. You know, it was a lot of trial and error, a lot of losing money, a lot of deaths, the hurricane. And again, because it was mostly the Everglades, I've read even in reports of expeditions earlier on that, you know, kind of concluded the reports by saying that it was just a vast and useless marsh and it'll never be anything. And, you know, it's very much in the glades itself. It's very much of a time capsule. You can really feel that spirit that still remains there. And so you really get that essence of like the old Florida and the old South Florida too.
Well, and I think when most people think of the frontier, they think of the Old West, they think of cowboys, they think of that kind of image, and that's really not what we have down here. So when you think of Belgrade and the Glades area as a frontier, are you trying to sort of expand people's image, or are you trying to sort of subvert that image of the frontier?
Well, it is totally actually very much like the cowboys. I mean, instead of the bandit cowboys, you know, we had the moonshiners out here and we totally had this story. I mean, in the Everglades, people would come out here to, you know, escape and just hide out too. I mean, so we totally have very much our own parallel of those Western stories here. And if you look at, you know, the history, the stories are like not much different from the old Western films, you know, it's just the backdrop is a bit different.
So I wanted to talk as well about one of the photos you have in your exhibit of a woman and then a baby doll. So talk to me a little bit about who's in this photo and the backstory behind it.
So that is the first, considered to be the first anatomically correct African-American doll. And it was basically built, made by a woman named Sarah Creech in Belgrade. And she was actually close friends with Zora Neale Hurston, the author of Their Eyes Are Watching Out, who also lived in Belgrade and contributed when she was working on this project. But yeah, in that photograph, I have a Mary Owens, who she actually, when she was a little girl, was one of the models for the doll. And basically the process of making the doll was photographing some children in Belgrade and then creating basically a drawing and then the rendering of that for the doll. But Sarah Creech believed, you know, there wasn't anything like it before. It was basically just, you know, a white doll painted black. So it didn't really, she wanted the children to have something that they could admire, you know, and so that was the creation of that.
And how did you find Mary?
Oh, so she works at the city of Belgrade. Belgrade is dripping in history. Everyone has a story there. Everyone has some roots there, and everyone's proud to be from there. That's for sure. You can't really turn a corner without every street sign, everything, you know, has more than one story about it.
Another photo that you have is of the Harvest Queen. Can you tell me a little bit about this particular Harvest Queen and then the background of the Harvest Queens in Belgrade?
Yeah, so that Harvest Queen, she's a 2017 Harvest Queen. Name is Caroline Stein. Her family, the Stein family have been there many generations. It's an incredible story. The great-grandfather originally was a lock tender there in right there from the lake. So he would see a lot of the steamboats coming in and out and would control, you know, that. But so the Harvest Queen tradition, that was something that began around in the 40s or so. And basically, this was your average hometown beauty pageant. And so the archival materials that I have are for, you know, those were the Harvest Queen contenders of the past. But it's just amazing to me that, you know, it's a tradition that still remains, and that's a strong sense of identity in it. And she's really, in that photograph to me, she's the princess of the Everglades there.
Your last project was photographing Miracle Village, which is a community that has a lot of convicted sex offenders, and it's located near Pahokee. What motivated you to explore that area and its people through your photography?
Okay, the fact that there was a sex offender community, I was like, what? And then it just happened from there. I mean, everything is just curiosity. It's just, I'm led by this, like, whatever curiosity I have. And I think that in terms of the sex centers, it's just something that I had no idea about. Of course, I just understood it to be this monstrous thing. And then it came to be something that was completely not what I thought it was. And then that was the story to tell for me. It's also interesting, reflection on society it was for me, how we deal with this kind of issue, and like how much do we understand about something like this, and I think you learn a lot from the things that you don't want to talk about or the things that you kind of, you know, put in a corner or something. You learn a lot more from those things, and it's important to look at those things.
And you said it surprised you and it sort of upset some of your preconceived notions going in to talk to these people and to learn more about them as you photograph them. Talk to me a little bit more about that. What surprised you?
Yeah, I mean, just that they were normal people. You know, you kind of paint them in your head as, I mean, these monsters. And there certainly are cases that are very, like, strong. But the issue with that is that, you know, that makes up a very small percentage of the cases. So, again, there's a ton of other cases. You know, you have the consensual teenage relationships and really some things that really aren't fair. And then just understanding the human the aspect of this, that, you know, they are humans. And I think that's something that we don't want to think of them as. And again, we don't want to look at them as that way. So I thought it was important to look at them as you would anyone else. And I thought the best way to do that is, creating the most intimate portrait that I could. I'm always interested in that, like seeing, I guess, the other and like not how we are different, but like how we are the same. Yeah.
Speaking with artist Sofia Valiente, her new photo exhibit, Foreverglades, is on display on a 1920 steamboat replica in West Palm Beach. So, as you said, you yourself have been living in Belgrade for 5 years. What drew you to that place in the first place, and what made you want to put roots down and stay?
I went to FIU, and I finished college, and I decided to, you know, explore. I did photography, and, you know, it didn't cut it for me just photographing, you know, my family and friends. That wasn't really what my interest was, and it's kind of what you kind of start doing in school to learn how to take pictures. But, you know, I wanted to explore and see what was out there. And, you know, amazing to me that 1 hour away from where I grew up, there was this community that was just absolutely different from everything. I mean, it's agricultural community. It's just the opposite of what our communities are, which are development. And it's just like so much history. I mean, generations, you know, Florida is such a transient place. And so, you know, whether you live in Florida or Miami, you can, you know, you can move around and not feel like an attachment. I went to a place where there's just these generations that have been there forever. I mean, they're written about in history books that are written in the 60s, and those families are still there, and it's just like, whoa. And I just kind of got hooked. If you didn't know anything, you would just pass one stoplight and you'd leave, and you would never think twice about it on your road trip up to a Disney or something or whatnot. But, you know, it's so extremely rich in history, and it's just I wanted to, you know, to give that, tell that story.
Well, and one of the things I think about sometimes is, especially over here on the east side of Palm Beach County near the coast, you're going to find that a lot of people, I feel like, are more likely to drive the hour, 2 hours, depending on traffic, down to Miami than they are to drive the hour over to the west side of their own county. Did that play into your decision to bring that exhibit here to West Palm?
Yeah, I mean, while I would love to have the boat in Belgrade, you know, I want to bring this to the coastal communities. You know, I want to bring the Glades to the coast, so that, you know, you can experience what life is like out there, but also the history, you know. And we're all connected. We all have a shared history. You know, we all were in pretty much most, not all, you know, we have the ridge on the coast, but most of us, you know, we were the Everglades, and, you know, thinking about all our summer communities, Western Miami, we all come from that same cloth, you know. And so I wanted to really connect here, this glades, this agricultural area, and, you know, the coast.
Well, and from the sound of things, especially with the steamboats, they used to be more connected. There used to be that literal artery just running to the glades and the lines, the ships running along them. So This is almost a return to, like, hey.
Exactly. This is the opening up the time portal here. I mean, this is exactly what I wanted to have done. You know, bring a piece of the glades. You know, the glades is so dripping in this kind of old historic relics. And I wanted to recreate something and bring it to the coast. And in terms of the steamboat, I just thought, how awesome would it be? I mean, you grew up in Florida, you have these ponds everywhere, and you're like, what are these, like, random ponds everywhere, right? And they're part of when you develop a, you know, make a community or a, you know, apartment complex, you have to, there's stormwater treatment, you know, you hold the water, you know, so the areas don't flood. And I just thought, what about, you know, putting a boat in one of them, and just, like, one that happened to have a historical significance, so you wouldn't be able to tell it, but... on top of that, juxtapose it with this really modern, you know, architecture of downtown, you know, West Palm Beach. I thought, wow, wouldn't that be just pretty special?
Right, because this exhibit is by the Kravis Center. It's by downtown West Palm. It really is. It's kind of a small boat, so I don't know how easily you can necessarily see it from the road, but in theory, you can see it from these really populous areas. And you said you grew up about an hour away from Belgrade. Where was that?
I grew up in Davie. Okay. Davie, Florida, another old town place. That was the Everglades.
So you, as you said, you've been photographing Belgrade for 5 years now, and this exhibit has pictures from throughout the 5 years. How have the pictures you've been able to take and the stories you've been able to tell, how has that changed over the 5 years?
This is like, you know, it's my home now, and it's a family, and I'm very, very much integrated in the community there. And so I think... You have an idea about what something is as an outsider, and then it's amazing when you're not an outsider anymore. And this is like, so the things that you thought were interesting are like kind of become, oh, that was superficial, right? And then you become more interested in like the heart and soul of something. So, you know, when you live somewhere, it's just a really incredible experience living and photographing. That's really, I think, the only way I'd want to do it. You know, I never like to be behind this kind of glass of like, looking, but I kind of almost want to live it. I mean, there's always, you're never going to be exactly like the people you live with, but, you know, just as much, you know, I want to be part of that world.
Thank you so much, Sophia.
Thank you.
That was WLRN Palm Beach County reporter Madeline Fox's conversation with photographer Sophia Valiente. Valiente has been photographing life in the Glades communities for the past 5 years. Her photographs are on display in a replica of a 1920 steamboat. It's in West Palm Beach. You can learn more by going to WLRN.org. Well, still to come, what is the sleep gap and how does it impact people of color? That question is part of a new exhibit for Art Week that's coming up next.
Took you back on the riverboat, honey. There's nothing left to do. I took you back on the sailboat, honey. Till my eyes were bruised. Feels like I'm drowning. Feels like I'm drowning. Feels like I'm drowning. Feels like I'm drowning. Yeah.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN.
Duerme, duerme, negrito.
Those are some of the therapeutic sounds that you're going to hear at the Museum of Art and Design's latest exhibition. It's called Black Power Naps, or Siestas Negras. Afro-Latinx artist duo Navil Da Costa and Fanny Sosa are behind the project. The installation explores the concept known as the sleeping gap. It looks at how different races experience sleep and how people of color get less of it. The exhibition features beds and canopies where museum goers will actually get to get on the beds. You might actually take a nap. Tonight at the Mode, starting at 5 p.m., the artists will be hosting a party workshop. There will be dancing, guided meditations, and a discussion with the artists. You can find more information and see some of the photos of the exhibit at WLRN.org. I've got both Navil and Sosa here in the studio with me. It is such a pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate
Hello.
It.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
This is a fascinating exhibit, but I want to start with this. Please, both of you, explain to me, for you, what is the sleep gap? What does that mean to you?
Right.
Sosa.
Right. The sleep gap is a term coined by Stanford researchers that found out that there is a gap in how people of color, specifically black folks, sleep as opposed to their white counterparts. So black folks sleep on average an hour less every night. And also we sleep less deep than white people. So that means that we don't achieve the slow wave sleep stage.
The deep REM sleep.
The reparative stage, which is, you know, where the computer really goes out and the body, all the systems go into repair, basically. So that means that it creates more folks being more prone to diseases, diabetes, high cholesterol, stress, ravaging bodies, et cetera, et cetera. And so it has really long-lasting health impacts.
Navil, for you, I mean, what does the sleep gap mean for you personally? And how do you experience that?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I am the child of immigrants to the United States, and I also live my life as a trans, queer, black person. And I deal with a lot of having to put together my life by any means, and that means having a very overworked schedule. And I know this is true for myself and a lot of people in my generation, as well as my parents, my grandparents, etc. And so for me, the sleep gap is really also inherited sort of generational trauma, right? It is living in our bones. It is passed down through us, right? And so Black Power Naps is really addressing that directly, right? Very simply put, take a nap. And so for me, establishing a place where we can find rest and reparation is key.
Let's go into the exhibit. Mm-hmm. Take me in. I come into the room.
Yeah.
I've seen the photos. This mm-hmm. is really fascinating. But take me into the room, how you have it set up, and what is it you're trying to accomplish?
So when you first walk in, there is a altar that has custom entity goddesses of sleep and rest. And then as you come in, you're going to see that it is a sensory calming bath. So the light, the sound, the way that everything is installed is designed to be calming and to create a bit of a sound curtain away from the noise of the city. And so what you feel more than anything at first is that the sounds of the city are interrupted. You can't hear the huff and puff of the city.
And so it's part of it is the sound. Part of it, I notice, is the colors.
The colors, yes, definitely chromotherapy.
The colors.
And this is deliberate.
Yeah, we have a very anti-chromophobic approach. There are no white surfaces, if possible, with Black Power Naps. We try to make as much color as possible. We also know that color is something that is therapeutic.
Why no white?
Well, ultimately, we both have been navigating as artists for a while, and often the institutions we're working with have white walls, and I think, you know, people sort of associate rest and sleep and taking care of yourself with whiteness and sort of white linens and white space, white sand, etc.
White people,
exactly. So we're really trying to create a splash of color in the representation around sleep and rest and self-care.
Let's get to one of the pieces. You have a bed that's made of dried coffee beans, correct?
Black beans.
Explain that to me. How is that set up and what does that mean?
Sure. Sosa, you want to explain
that? Well, the black bean bed was designed with panic attacks in mind. And for every island, we sort of follow a bit of an elemental idea like fire, earth, water, and air. So the black bean bed is one of the earth station or islands. And whenever you're having a panic attack, which, you know, is one of the results of being exhausted, overworked, etc., etc., you often need to be to feel secure in your body, to feel weight on your body. So we actually wanted to have an island in the installation where you can you feel you can go under the earth. And so both being Afro-Latinx, Caribbean, you know, we wanted to work with a staple, which is the black beans. And the black beans, they allow for you to actually be completely submerged, but you can still breathe. And so when we're coming with this inheritance, right, of lack of sleep, but also this idea of not sinking, you know, like this idea of not being able to rest, not being able to actually let go into sleep.
To breathe.
Right, it's really healing, and it is a very unusual experience to have in an art space, to be able to be fully submerged, including your face, in a material that is organic, that is also astringent, so it actually absorbs the excess water that sometimes gets deposited in the limbs after a long day. So the black bean bed is actually really popular with like the senior population, because they come in and like, you know, you put your legs in, it also does acupressure on your feet, and it massages out the tension and like...
I'm feeling very relaxed right now as you say that. You know what, this is the other thing that's beautiful about this, is that you welcome people to be in mm-hmm. these beds, to be in these spaces and feel it and experience it. It's not just a visual experience.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think this really challenges the art-going experience as well, right? Like, I think we've predominantly heard, you know, we never thought that art could be like this, mm. right? Coming to the exhibition, being able to participate and actually walk away with something, which is rest and the idea to sleep, to be idle, and that being okay.
Mm-hmm. Again, I'm talking with Naviel da Costa and Fanny Sosa. They are Afro-Latinx artist duo behind the new Museum of Art and Design installation. It's called Black Power Naps or Siestas Negras. It looks at what they're calling the sleep gap, as they've been describing, and it's how people of color are getting less sleep than their white counterparts. And the art is challenging us to think about that gap and think about the many levels of why that is. The exhibition features beds, canopies, where the museum goers, again, can lie down in the beds and experience this. And by the way, you can see photos. We have some of them on our website at WLRN.org. Where did the idea come from? I mean, how did it start, and how did the two of you come together on this? Did it originate with one of you or both of you talking about it?
I mean, I think we both were experiencing that on a very real level, like the sleep gap, right? But it really came to fruition after leading a workshop in Berlin with some black creatives, and somebody was like, I wish we could all nap together. And I just kind of looked around the room and I said, black power naps. And I called Sosa that same day. We had already been collaborating. And so from that moment, it sort of became realized into a space that it needed to be.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, because you're going to be leading a sort of meditation, right?
Mm-hmm. A platonic play party.
Describe, how does that work?
So one of the things that in our research we found out about sleep and rest is that touch is actually a really important component. And not just any touch, but platonic touch. So touch that is not sexual, touch that is that feels safe. And it is a particular kind of touch that, for example, me as a migrant, I don't have. Why? Because I don't have my family with me. And the only occasions that I have to be touched are clinical occasions, medical occasions, violence, or sexual occasions. And so one of the things that we want to do in this platonic play party is to be able to explore a touch that feels safe, that is safe, and that more than anything is platonic, because the research says that it helps us sleep better. We are humans and we are very tactile as a species, right? Whenever we are not being touched, our nervous system is telling us, you're in danger, girl. You know, mm-hmm. you're about to be taken by a predator, you're about to die. It is a very ingrained evolutionary message that the endocrinous and nervous system sends out. And so when we spend days, months, years isolated in this way, it actually ends up also reinforcing what we were talking about, health issues that have to do with lack of sleep and rest. And so our idea behind organizing this platonic play party is to be able to be playful with touch in a safer space, in a space that is not sexual, that is not necessarily, you know, going there. So
when you do these, usually what's the reaction from people? What do you hear from people after they have the experience?
I think people are surprised. They're surprised at how much of that was easy to sort of find touch and define touch, also define consent and boundaries and desire. In a wholesome and safe environment where there's no expectation. Most of the time people are feeling like, whoa, I needed that. And they do feel that sense of relief that we're trying to evoke with this practice, right? Which is the relief of touch, which lends itself to the relief of your own body, right? And being able to relax into your own body.
Do you ever run into a situation where you talk to someone and you're telling them what is about to happen and they're already uncomfortable before they even do that? Mm-hmm. And part of it too is this, when you think about beds, that it's probably the one piece of furniture in our home that we're most intimate with because we spend so much time on. That's when you go to a hotel or anywhere else, you always feel uncomfortable in some other bed. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you run into that. People just like, wait, this is not my bed. This is not my space I'm comfortable with. What happens in that situation?
So that's a really good question. I think there's several levels to it. The space is not just about sleep. The sleep gap is not just about sleep. It's actually about rest in the shape of downtime, leisure time, being able to play, as in not be productive, you know, not do things in order to have an outcome that will mean money or productivity. And so in many ways what we're we're proposing with Black Power Naps is different islands where you can use your body playfully. And so you can sleep in those, but you can also jump in the trampoline and work in your breathing. The proposal is to come back to your body. So that's one thing. And then of course there's all kinds of responses, and there are people that obviously have qualms or that don't necessarily feel comfortable. And that's the idea. The space is not there to push you to do anything you're not comfortable with. It's just a proposal, and then you can take it as far as you want.
I wanted to ask about another piece you have there at the installation. This one, Rooted in Water.
Yeah.
The Atlantic Reconciliation. Describe that one for me.
Sure. It is called the Atlantic Reconciliation because the Atlantic Ocean is a very charged ocean. It is where the transatlantic slave trade occurred. Many Afro-diasporic people have crossed that ocean alive and not alive. And so we really want to reconcile that trauma, that history, through creating a surface that is of water. You don't need to be submerged in it. You can still have the sensation of water. You can be in touch with the water. The bed itself is a water bed, and there are drum shakers installed to the base and a subwoofer. So the sound of the space that we also created is vibrating through that water, and therefore vibrating through the waters of your body and healing.
Is there a chance for people to understand that, you know, the symbolism that you have for each of these beds before they lie on those beds, so they understand what they're experiencing? They get the chance to learn so that when they're in it, they're like, okay, I see what they're telling me.
Mm-hmm. It comes with a publication. The show has a
magazine.
A magazine in where we sort of explain and dwell into these things, and they're free of charge. So people can just grab them as they arrive into the space and then take them
home.
Take them home and take them to the beds and read up on what's happening to them.
For the event that you have coming up, what do you tell people on how to approach this? How should they come mentally prepared for this?
Well, we have a central phrase, which is, if you see a Black person sleeping, don't call the cops. So that's sort of like the maxim of the space, because it is it welcomes everyone, right? And so it is a mixed space. And there is a bit of a outstanding narrative that Black people at rest are criminals or are loitering or are criminalized. And we know, we all have heard the stories of Willie McCoy, who got shot while he was sleeping in his car, or a Yale student as well, a PhD student, that the police was called on her because she was taking a nap on a student room. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it is a whole negotiation between what's safe, what is, how do you occupy the space, and who do you center?
Again, Nevil Da Costa and Fanny Sosa, they are the Afro-Latinx artists behind the Museum of Art Design exhibition. It's called Black Power Naps or Siestas Negras. You can learn more and check out some of the photos. Please go to WLRN.org. Nevil Sosa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it. All right, that's our program for today, this Thursday, December 5th. Coming up next week on Sundial, our conversation with the legendary South Florida columnist and author Carl Hyacin. His latest book focuses on graduation advice in his classical, cynical style. We also discussed his decades-long relationship with fellow Miami Herald columnist and humorist Dave Barry. Plus, we have a one-hour special coming up next week focused on homelessness in South Florida. And we want to hear from you. What should local governments and nonprofits be doing to address homelessness? Is it about providing more housing, treating mental illness? Is it about drug abuse? We want to hear your thoughts, especially about what's going on in your community. You can email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRNSundial. We will continue to carry the congressional impeachment hearings with coverage and analysis from NPR. Coverage continues on Monday. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.